The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good evening. It's nice to see you all. So for this evening, I thought that I would start by reading an excerpt from something that was written, I don't know, maybe 40 years ago. I don't know the exact dates, in Thailand, and by an Australian, so it was written in English by somebody in Thailand. And it's called A Walk in the Woods. And I've just excerpted a little piece of this. It starts like this. It's by Fra Kantipalo. Who also, his name is Lawrence Mills, also. Come with me for a walk in the woods. It is hot, silent, and nearly midday, but there are patches of shade here and there where we may sit. Above us, young leaves of translucent green match their brilliance against the starling blue sky. I just love this sentence, actually. It feels, you know, like you're out in the woods in the springtime or something like this. But these young, tender leaves are full of holes, delicacies for the great beetles that bumble about in the evening air. Lower down these trees, the more mature leaves are ragged and lend to the forest a threadbare look. Though they must be tough, still it seems they are the food of some insect. So here we go, this idea of walk in the woods. For me, sometimes I think of, poets describe these beautiful experiences, being with nature, heart opening. And this person is looking at, oh wait, here's some of the things that maybe we don't see at first look. Here and there you can see at the base of branches and around the lower parts of the trees, yellow leaves hanging, stiffly awaiting, as it were, the executioner, who will come as a breath of wind and bring them down. Parted, they are disjoint forever, one changing process from another changing process. They fall with a crash among the undergrowth. There they join hundreds of thousands which fell before them and litter all the ground with a crackly layer of decay. But they do not just decay slowly at their own speed. Their decay is quickened by a myriad of ants, termites, worms, and funguses, all ready for food and fighting to get it, a fearsome underground jungle in miniature. So the author goes on. I won't read all of this, but I'll skip more towards the end. If impermanence meant change all the time towards better and happier states, how excellent our world would be. But impermanence is allied with endings, too. All compounds break down. All made things fall to pieces. All conditioned things pass away with the passing of those conditions. Everything and everybody, that includes you and me, deteriorates, ages, decays, breaks up, and passes away. And we, living in the forest of desires, are entirely composed of the impermanent. Yet our desire impels us not to see this. Though impermanence stares us in the face from every single thing around, and it confronts us when we look within, our minds and our bodies are rising and passing away. So the author ends with this statement. So don't turn on the TV, go to the movies, read a book, seize some food, or 100 other distractions just to avoid seeing this. This is the one thing really worth seeing. For the one who fully sees this sets themselves free. So I read this and I felt kind of touched by this different idea of what it's like to be in nature, as the trees, and then to see like, well, you know, actually there's these insects there that are eating on them, and then it's just natural that leaves nest, that they fall from the trees and to the floor. And we know this. We all know this. I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. That everything in the world has this quality of not lasting. That things that have the nature to begin have the nature to end. Things that have the nature to be born have the nature to die. And experiences that have the nature to arise have the nature to pass away. So this idea of impermanence, this teaching of impermanence, this concept of impermanence, this observation of impermanence, can be understood in two ways. One is the more obvious ordinary understanding, which I partly just described by spending a little time out in nature, we can see it. And the second is an understanding of impermanence that is not so obvious, and that is available to a mind that is quieted, to a mind that has some settledness and some stability. So this, of course, this ordinary understanding of impermanence is available to everybody. Seasons change, societies change, the weather changes. And noticing this isn't necessarily uncomfortable. Especially when we're experiencing difficulties, impermanence is helpful, knowing that this experience that we're going to have is going to end soon. Whether that experience, that difficulty is in the body, or if it's in the mind, or our emotional state, whatever it is, it's going to change. Doesn't mean, of course, that it changes in the time frame that we wish it would change. But it does. It does end. So in some cases, impermanence is something that we're quite glad about. As well as seeing this, the natural ordinary state of impermanence can help really support us to have some great wisdom, some tremendous wisdom. I saw this recently in myself. I, of course, knew about this, but it's a little bit different, right, when we actually have these experiences. When somebody in my family died, it's a little bit of a wake-up bell, right? When somebody like, oh, yeah, I knew we all die, but somehow it's a little bit of a wake-up bell. And this inquiry of setting priorities. Yeah, what's really important when we see someone's dying or has died? To help bring some wisdom, kind of shake us up a little bit and to think about, yes, we are of the nature, we will die also. And also this whole idea of learning something new, cultivating a practice, discovering more and more freedom, depends on this idea that things change. Right? If things didn't change, we wouldn't bother with a meditation practice. If things were always the same, right? Meditation practice helps us to get a little more stability in mind, helps us to see things that we might not ordinarily see. So of course, I'm not, as I said, I'm not telling you anything you don't already know. But there's this less immediately perceptible or more subtle aspect of this idea of impermanence. That is, when the mind quiets down, we start to see the moment-to-moment arising and passing of experiences. In fact, as the concentration builds, as focus builds, as the mind has a certain amount of collectedness and there's a certain amount of stability, we start to see that actually everything is in flux. Even in the moment to moment, just seeing it, that nothing is quite as stable as it might appear initially. One example might be some discomfort in the body. Maybe there's a strong sensation in the knee. Sometimes it's tempting just to say, oh, there's that pain again. And to think, it's always here when I sit. But then as the mind starts to get quieted down and a little bit settled and connected or collected, can start, and if we turn our attention towards those sensations and try to like pinpoint where exactly is that strong sensation, we'll see that it's very difficult actually to pinpoint precisely. It's in flux, it's moving a little bit. That movement may be some broad stretches or some big movement, or it may just be 1 millimeter over to the left. Or maybe if the location isn't shifting, maybe the intensity is shifting. Maybe there's a sense of tingling or throbbing, which has a changing nature. Or maybe it's the, we don't even notice it all the time. Maybe we're paying attention to this sensation in the knee, and then there's a sound, and then we're distracted, we're thinking about the sound, and then we come back to this sensation. So when we really start to pay attention, we start to see more and more about how actually everything is in flux. It has this vibrant, dynamic quality to it. So for this type of impermanence, that is seeing things that are in flux and are changing and are in constant, we might use this word inconstant as a translation of the Pali word anicca, as the Pali word, which often gets translated as impermanent. But impermanent implies that things are ending. Doesn't only mean that, but it often implies that. But this idea of inconstant points more towards the changing nature. Maybe they're not ending as much as they're in flux and dynamic. And so in some ways that is ending, but it's also beginning together. So this, both of these aspects happening. And so one way that this becomes obvious, that the things are in flux or inconstant, is if we shift our perception away from the objects that are out there, away from the things that seem stable and constant and seem to have a certain steadiness, and instead, if we're noticing our experiences, that is, the collection of mental events and the collection of bodily events that we're having, and to see how those experiences are not constant. So without worrying about the state of existence of these objects, this bell, this clock, this striker, this piece of paper, this Dharma dog, but to instead turn towards and pay attention to are the felt experience that we're having in this precise moment, we can see that before the story-making mind has gotten busy, before the lot of the trains of thought have left the station, that it's one experience after another, after another, after another, after another. As fast as your mind can see it, is as fast as they're changing. And the more quiet our mind has, that is, the more stability. In contrast to that stability, we can see that our experience is moving really fast. So this sense of vibrancy or dynamic quality of things always changing becomes really strong. But in order to see the kind of like the vibratory quality of our experiences, as I've mentioned, requires a certain amount of stability. And so we could cultivate some stability. Of course, a big part of meditation practice is to do this very thing, is to bring a quieting to our experience. So one way to do this is to, as best we can, just to turn toward our experience. So it might be that we're feeling anything but stable. We're feeling restless. We want to jump up and run away. Or our mind is like rehearsing something that happened earlier today, or trying to remind ourselves or plan for the future. Remind ourselves what to pick up at the grocery store on the way home. So if there's a certain amount of agitation or unsettledness, if there's ways in which we are feeling fragmented or jumping around or generally restless, there may be layers and layers of this agitation. There may be that with the body we're feeling fidgety, but maybe with the body there's a certain amount of steadiness, but the mind is feeling really fidgety, so to speak. We can just recognize that. Oh yeah, here's fidgetiness. Oh yeah, here's restlessness in the mind. Here's some aversion, here's some fantasy making in the mind. And we shouldn't underestimate how powerful it is just to notice the restlessness, notice the unsteadiness. And sometimes that may be just enough to help bring some settledness in. Sometimes the just recognizing what's happening, in some ways kind of like aligning with the reality of the moment, the truth of the moment, just helps things kind of quiet down and settle down. It might mean that the next moment there's some more agitation, but then again, we can just align with that agitation. And align, I mean, by just to say, yes, this is what's happening. Agitation is happening. And in that moment of just recognizing the agitation, that precise moment, not so much agitation, because there's some stability in that we've recognized what's actually happening. But it might be that we need a little bit more. So that is, can there be a manner in which we recognize the agitation? Can there be a way in which we do it? Can there be an approach that we take to recognize the restlessness, the uncomfortable feeling in the body, the difficult emotion, whatever it might be? Can we recognize things in a way that gives space to them, that allows them to be there? And that we stop being in contention with the experience and not in conflict with them, but instead just to be with them. And one way we can do this is to ask ourselves, just a very gentle inquiry, how can I be aware of this agitation that is not agitating? How can I be aware of this agitation? How can I be aware of this conflict with what's happening? I wish it weren't there. How can I be aware of this conflict in a way that is not in conflict with the conflict? How can I not be in contention with this feeling of contention that I often have when things are uncomfortable or difficult? So it's just a gentle inquiry. We don't necessarily have to dig to find the answer. The point here is to ask the question. How can I be with this restlessness in a way that doesn't promote restlessness? And then to ask this question is to begin the process of extracting ourselves from disentangling ourselves from this contention or conflict or that's happening, and allow some steadying to happen. I'm not saying that everything that's difficult is going to all of a sudden disappear and go away. I'm not saying that a difficult sensation in the knee, I'm pointing to this right now, my knee's a little bit uncomfortable, or the difficult emotion is going to go away. But what I am saying is approaching it in this way helps kind of drain some of the suffering out of it, helps drain some of the problemness out of the experience. So it's not so much that the experience is different, or the experience is different, but the way that we approach it changes the ecosystem, and there can be a shift in our experience. So it brings the shift away from what's actually happening to our relationship to what's happening. And that's where the freedom lies. And that's where the steadiness can come in, and the collectedness can come in. If we can bring some space to whatever's happening, then there can be some steadiness that allows maybe some of these difficult things to be arising, but there's still some stability just with the knowing. Just with the being present, just aligning with it. So that's one way we can cultivate some stability, is to ask ourselves this gentle inquiry: is there a way that I can be with this experience in a way that is not contributing to any more instability? And sometimes that's just sufficient to ask that question, because to ask the question is to be disentangled from it. A second way is to notice any sensations of well-being that are also happening at the same time. I think probably many of you know this, right? We're having a whole range of experiences all the time, but there's a selection bias towards those which are the most difficult. And we may be completely ignoring things that are either neutral or even positive. We might be ignoring the pressure of the chair or the cushion against our bodies. We might be ignoring some of the subtle sounds in the room as we shift our posture and my voice. The sounds of sometimes the train outside. So there might also be a little corner of your experience that has a little bit of contentment or well-being or ease. So even though there may be some discomfort, either in the body, in the mind, the emotion, there may also be a little sense of like, oh, okay, I'm doing something that I made a commitment to meditate regularly, and here I am, I'm doing it. Or I wanted to get out of the house to do something else than the usual, and here I am, I'm doing it. Whatever it might be. So a second thing we can do to help cultivate stability is to either shift our attention towards something that's having some well-being, some contentment, or something completely neutral, or to just expand our experience and just be noticing a range of things that are happening. The third thing that we can do to help cultivate some stability is to pay attention to our posture and to what our body is doing. Of course, our body and our minds are connected. And so to have some stillness in a way that's comfortable and yet has some uprightness in a way that's not stiff, but have some ease, can be a great way to support the mind to feel a little bit more collected. I think all of us have this experience that when we're feeling impatient, to be like tapping our fingers or to be jiggling in some kind of way. And that just feeds the mind, which then feeds the body, which feeds the mind. Sometimes it's hard to get the mind to settle down, but maybe if we can just encourage the body to settle down, can be a great way to support the mind. So then, as I said, with some greater stability, some quietness, often we can see the changing nature of our experiences. And then when we start to see in a really deep way or repeatedly the changing nature of our experiences, something important starts to happen. Something potentially really transformative and helpful starts to happen. We start to see, it doesn't quite make sense to hold on to some of these things so tightly because things are changing. It doesn't quite make sense to hold on to my irritation because I see that the irritation isn't quite as constant. It's actually in flux too. It's dynamic. It doesn't quite make sense to hold on to this idea that I'm always planning and I'm planning and I'm never going to stop planning and why do I even bother meditating because I'm always planning and I'm planning the next time I'm going to meditate. Whatever it might be. We start to see, like, oh yeah, but that's fluctuating too. We're not always planning, for example, in the mind. There are times when we're maybe listening to the sound. Maybe we're adjusting our posture. Maybe we have thoughts about what we're going to have for dinner. Planning our day tomorrow in a way that's different than what we were planning before. So more we see, we start to see that things change, so I don't have to hold on to them. I don't have to cling so tightly. Because what becomes evident is actually what we're holding on to are just ideas, just concepts. Because our experience is really changing all the time. We're holding on to views, to ideas. A good example I like of this is money, cash. Right? We all know that money is either just some electronic numbers on the computer somewhere, or pieces of paper, particular paper. So money itself isn't what we're holding on to. They're just these things, these objects that themselves don't have value. It's more our ideas about money. It's more about our ideas about what it means to be secure. It's more our ideas about what it means to have status, our ideas about what it means to pay one's bills or to what it means to owe money or to accumulate things. Or these are all just ideas. The things themselves are just, I don't know, would think of electrons somewhere, I guess, for a computer or pieces of paper. And we start to see more and more about what we're holding on to or what we're clinging to. Those things only appear stable because they're not actual experiences. They're ideas, concepts. Ideas about ourselves. Right? This is just an idea, as I pointed out, and all of you know, right? Our experiences are changing all the time. So in the Buddhist teaching, especially in early Buddhism that we practice here, there's a real pointing towards this. Noticing the difference between an experience, seeing all these mental events, the thoughts are changing, they're coming and going, and new ones. We can hear different things. These experiences are changing. If I ask you to pay attention to the sensations in your right hand, chances are you'll notice something that wasn't there just a moment ago. So in the Buddhist teachings are paying attention to what's actually happening here and now so that we can notice that they're changing, they're not constant as stable, so that we don't cling to them so tightly. It just naturally happens. As we start to see this, we start to see it just doesn't make sense to hold on to this because it's in flux. So the in the suttas, in the early Buddhist scriptures, the Buddha says this. Someone who is wise possesses wisdom. Okay, that's kind of self-explanatory. Someone who is wise possesses wisdom that understands arising and passing away, which is noble and penetrating, and which leads to the destruction of suffering. Because suffering, of course, is linked to holding on to things that are changing. It's impossible. Things change. But we're trying to hold on to them and think that somehow we're going to find safety or security or happiness. And to be sure, we will find some safety, some security, and some happiness by holding to some things. And that works until it doesn't. And there is always a case where it gets to the point where it doesn't work anymore. So instead of holding tightly, can we hold things with open-handedly and letting our experiences, our ideas just arise and pass away and allow them to be with what's actually happening as opposed to trying to hold on to a concept? And of course, the concepts that we hold on to the most tightly are the concepts we have about ourselves. I'm a person who is always on time. It's very important to be on time. But of course, there are times when you weren't on time, or I don't know, I just made this up. Maybe that's not a good example. But it's amazing the kind of ideas that we have about ourselves, some of these underlying beliefs that we have about what it means to be a good person, what it means to be a bad person. Often we're holding on to these concepts. But the freedom is to turn towards our experiences. We need concepts. I'm not saying not to use them. We need them in our daily life. They are enormously helpful. But to recognize that they're not the same thing as our experiences. Concepts are labels, words that we slap on things, and they tend to be stable and static, whereas our experience is moving and in flux all the time. These are two different things. And freedom is recognizing that these are different, and to align with our actual experiences. And then the concepts will shift by themselves, but to align with what's actually happening. So this insight into impermanence, as I said, occurs when we're paying attention to our experiences. But it can also happen in a really dramatic fashion. This usually happens when a person is really settled, like maybe being on a meditation retreat, and they might see impermanence in such a deep way that it's transformative, that a certain type of clinging just is no longer possible. Just there, like this deep understanding, like, you know, that's just not going to happen. In the same kind of way, when you learn to read, you can't look at things that are written in an alphabet that you're familiar with, in a language you're familiar with, and not read them, right? It's just hard. You just can't do that. You learned things a particular way, and it just happens. The same thing happens with a really deep penetrative insight into the inconstancy of experience, that there's just, you've just a deep learning that clinging doesn't make sense. And certain types of clinging just aren't possible anymore, and there's greater and greater freedom available. So this particular insight that I'm pointing to right here, the one that's really transformative, it's not something we can force to happen. It's not something we can will to happen. It's not something that we can search for. It happens when the conditions are right. But it becomes more obvious when we're not lost in story making, when we're not lost in fantasy or just with the mental experiences, but that we're here with what's actually happening. And when there's the sense of self, when there's the sense of I have to do this, I need to not do that, and I should do this, and I'm having this experience, when that's kind of softened, for example, instead of saying I'm agitated, it's kind of a feeling like more like, oh, agitation has arisen. There's a little bit less of a self there. When they're having that experience, that's when this really transformative insight can happen into the inconstant nature of things. But it's also possible that we can help create the conditions for this insight to arise. And one way is to do, as I hinted at a little bit with the guided meditation earlier, is to choose the changing nature of experience to be the object of our meditation. That is, for example, you can choose sounds. You can do a meditation where you just notice sounds. Often we're doing the breath, right? But instead of just, for example, you can do sounds. You can hang out for a little bit just noticing the sounds. Of course, sounds arise and pass away. All of them do. Hopefully. Maybe they don't all do. If you have tinnitus, maybe it's a little bit different experience. And then you can notice actually to let go of the exact experience of the sounds, and as best you can, just to notice the changing nature. Louder, 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 softer, softer. Oh, one from another direction. This direction, louder, softer, another direction. So just to notice the variety and how things are just changing. So this is one way in which you can kind of tune in to the changing nature of experience specifically. You can choose one sense door for the example I just gave, sound. You could do it with anything. You could do it with vision if your eyes are open. Just how the eyes dot around a little bit and things go in and out of focus and there's different things come into the sense visual field. Of course, bodily sensations also really change. The mind really changes. That sometimes is a little bit more difficult to watch because we get lost in thought. But just to pay attention to one particular aspect of our experience, that is that the changing aspect. And so we're not paying attention to the particulars of the experience, but the fact that it's changing. So this can be a type of mindfulness. It's a little bit different than what we often are teaching or talk about, but it's one way that we can incline the mind to notice this impermanence. And then when we do this, we might find that we get a sense of, a real sense of okayness, a real sense of ease actually might arise, that, oh yeah, everything's changing. I'm changing, the objects out there are changing. And there can be a real sense of beauty to this, a real sense, I'll say my own experience, I've a little sense of awe, actually, and beauty. And with that is a real sense of well-being. There's also a connection to everything. My experiences are changing, your experiences are changing, and your experiences are changing, everybody's experiences are changing. So in some ways there's kind of a connection to everything. And then there will be times in our lives when changes are happening and it's not the way that we want them to be. It's not maybe there's something really precious and dear to us. Maybe it's our health. Maybe it's a loved one is ill or has a terrible diagnosis or has recently died, or having some familiarity with change, having some recognition that, yes, it is a part of our experience, can really support us in those times when change is happening and it's the last thing that we're wishing for. But having recognized that there can be some ease with change, with the fluctuating nature of our experience, can be a big support for us. And it can connect us to each other. So in this way, we can cultivate some stability. Does two things. It allows us to see the changing nature of things. Because the mind is stable, then we can see the subtle changes that we can't see when the mind is busy. And also stability can also highlight the changing nature. When we start to see the changing nature, two things can happen. One, if we see it often enough and or deep enough, there can be a sense of like, oh, it just doesn't make sense to hold on. It just will naturally happen. Just naturally, there'll be some letting go. When there's letting go, there's more freedom, more ease. Also, when we start to see the changing nature of things, we start to have a little bit more comfort and familiarity and maybe agility with change. So when change is happening in a way that's uncomfortable, we can have a little bit more ease with it. We don't have to necessarily fight it. And of course, because everything is changing and we don't have to fight it, support some stability in all areas of our lives. So this way, the kind of the stability and the impermanence, the changing nature, can really help us to find greater ease and greater peace, and greater freedom with what's actually happening. So maybe I'll say that as a closing, it doesn't really matter where we are in our meditation practice, whether we're a beginner, whether we've been practicing for a little while, or we've been practicing for decades. We can see change, or whether we've never meditated, that's another place too, right? We can see change in all these different parts of our life and with our meditation practice. And in wherever we see it, is an opportunity to help support some relaxing of clinging and some letting go. Wherever we are in our meditation practice. So I think I'll end there and open it up for some questions or comments. And I'm okay with repeating the question if people prefer to not to be handling the microphone too, so we can do whatever feels comfortable.
Thank you for the talk. So, so since impermanence is a very natural part of life, and clinging is very common for all of us. Why do you think that we do that, since it's definitely not beneficial?
Because sometimes it's beneficial. Like we have life experiences, you know, like, okay, right now it just slips my mind, but sometimes, right, to hold on to an idea of like, okay, I want to, when I go into a library, I hold on to the idea that people behave like this when they're in a library. They're not yelling and shouting and running around. And I hold on to the idea that it's different when I'm out on the tennis court or basketball court or something like this. So there are some things that we do hold on to and that are serve us. So that's one. The second is why do we cling? I think this is actually a great question for practice. This is a great thing just to kind of like maybe a little inquiry to drop in. Like, why am I holding on? Or it could even be, what am I holding on to? Because maybe we don't even feel like we're holding on. And yet there's a lot of suffering happening. And the more we practice, the more that we see that actually suffering and clinging are synonyms. They really are. So whenever there's a lot of suffering, we could also ask, what am I holding on to? And why am I holding on? So actually, I think you asked such a great question for practice. Something for us to kind of explore for ourselves. Thank you, Ingrid.
Thank you for a brilliant talk. Isn't it also true that one of the reasons we may hold on to things that aren't good for us is out of habit?
Absolutely.
Is that there's that narrow habit that can be reversed, we now know. And that I find a lot of hope in that it's that new traits can be developed that reverse those habits.
Yeah, I feel inspired by that as well. This idea of like, oh yeah, we can train our minds. There is this neuroplasticity, and we can develop new habits and get rid of old habits. And there's so many books these days, right? And podcasts and all this kind of information, like how to develop new habits and all this. And part of it is because we can. Is because we can. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
I guess this is more of a comment, but, you know, you're talking about losing somebody or, you know, everything going on with the coronavirus or just every... It just brings me back to how we don't think that life is very precarious and we get these wake-up calls. And, you know, I had one last week and, you know, I sort of feel like we have this tendency to delude ourselves that it's a secure world.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think as you get older, you sort of get that on a much deeper level. But it's just there all the time. And I think that sort of is, to your point, the more you can sort of keep that really present, it really sort of makes life richer and you sort of appreciate it a lot more.
Thank you. I think it was last Saturday, Nikki Mercafori did a day long here in Maranasati, mindfulness of death. So just this regular practice of saying, you know, there's a number of ways you can do it, but I know a number of people who every day, part of their practice, have it's called the recollections, and one of them is, I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. Just to kind of help keep it in mind, and you have to do these specific practices to keep reminding this. And when Nikki talks about, when she's doing kind of this mindfulness of death, she talks about how it turns out to be a beautiful, beautiful practice, because the preciousness of our experience and kind of making clear what's really important and taking care of those things that are important. So, yeah, thank you for reminding us of that. Yeah, so can we send a microphone back there? See, there's one here.
So you talked about the nature of impermanence, anicca, and also not self, anatta. So for me, it's easy to see the anicca through meditation, mainly through vipassana. But how do you sort of observe the not self that you briefly mentioned? Through meditation, or do you usually observe through intellectual exercise?
So that there's a number of ways you can do that, and that could be like a whole another talk, of course, right? But maybe I'll just say this. Here's one thing. We often have this sense of a self with, like, of course we have a sense of self, right? You know, I'm here and you're there, and I'm the one that's going to drive, get into my car and go home, right? Of course we all have selves, right? But if we pay attention, we'll notice that there are sense of self. I'm using this phrase to mean, like, what does it mean to be me, really strongly separate from you out there, us, them, me, you. For example, like when we are really angry or we're having this sense of self-righteousness, there's a real strong sense of me, how dare they do this? Don't they know who I am? I'm going to do this when they're done or something like this. So there's a real strong sense of a self that has a particular really boundaries and really separate from everybody else. So that's a sense of self that's really distinct and strong. For that example, if I'm the one that's angry, I might have that. But also, there may be a time when I'm doing my favorite hobby or something that I like to do. There's some like art things that I like to do. And when I'm doing those, there is not a sense of self. I'm just lost in what I'm making with my hands. I'm just you know, doing this particular activity, and there is not a strong sense. There's no sense of Diana, I'm the one that's making that. There's just making is happening. This is part of the reason why people like to do arts, or sports are a good one too, right? With whatever sport it is, there's not a strong sense of self when you're lost in the sport, you're just doing this. So one end of the spectrum, there can be a really small sense of self, or maybe not small, soft. Maybe I'll say this word, soft. Over here, when we're filled with self-righteousness, there's a really more hard, brittle sense of self. And so a practice can be just to notice all throughout the day how the spectrum, we're going along this spectrum. All day long, you can just notice this. And then that start, just having that observation starts to feel like, oh yeah, the sense of self, well, which self is it? Am I the one that's over here at this end of the spectrum that's feeling, you know, self-righteous and upset? Or is it the self that's at this end of the spectrum that's barely even there? This doesn't have to be a complicated intellectual exercise. With meditation, really deep meditation. Usually this happens on retreat, not usually in the retreat setting, days, weeks, months, maybe in silence, that there's a real clarity that comes about this. And you just start to see, wow, okay, there's all these moments, experiences of having a self, but it's an experience just like any other experience. It comes and goes. Does that answer your question? It's kind of a long answer. Hope that was helpful. And now it's 9:02. So I want to respect everybody's time. So thank you for coming. And maybe just a friendly reminder. I feel funny saying this, but wash your hands. Wash your heads. It's a nice way for us to take care of ourselves and take care of each other. So thank you.